Welcome to our series on social capital. My name is Tristan Claridge, and I'm the director of the Institute for Social Capital, which is an independent research and consulting organization that focuses, not surprisingly, on social capital. And I'm joined by Lyndon Robison, who is Emeritus Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics at Michigan State University. Welcome, Lyndon.
Thank you, Tristan. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm very pleased to have found someone like you who share my really passionate interest in social capital.
Absolutely, and certainly we both share a passion for this concept of social capital, and we each have a long history of work on the concept. Lyndon and I come at it from different disciplines. Lyndon from economics, really, and my background perhaps is in sociology and social theory. And our different backgrounds and perspectives make for very interesting conversations and engaging debate. In this episode, we'll discuss the core idea of social capital, that is, that relationships matter and value, and how this can be recognized and communicated through the concept of social capital. So, Lyndon, let's start with how you became interested in the concept of social capital and when was it?
It actually started in 1984, 1985, when I was on sabbatic leave at Brigham Young University. And I had been very involved in my faith, and I wanted to write a book about economics that would appeal to a faith community. And so I said it shouldn't be too hard. And I was very disappointed and frustrated that I had a hard time explaining concepts of service and faith and caring and, emotional connections between people from a purely neoclassical economic background that was described by one behavioral economist as selfish people trading things. And so I was frustrated. I was looking for something to explain what wh why I couldn't really adapt a lot of the things that behavior that I cared about and I witnessed and I thought was important into my neoclassical economic framework.
Certainly, it seems like a lot of the early scholars were either in economics and perhaps not quite satisfied with the theorizing within economics and looking for something that was a bit different or outside of that neoclassical economic perspective. Or it was in fact from sociologists who were working quite closely with economics, or perhaps wanted to be seen and recognized by economists. So in those early days, did you have much interaction with people, either other economists or people in other areas of the social sciences?
So when I returned from sabbatic leave to Michigan State University, I wanted to find out what were some of the ideas in other disciplines that might help me bridge the understanding to behavior that I observed and admired and wanted to explain compared to the strictly neoclassical model of maximizing utility or well-being or maximizing profit if you're from the perspective of a producer. And so we formed an interest group that included sociologists and anthropologists, political scientists, and persons from other disciplines. We organized a seminar series that people from different points of view would have a chance to reflect on what they found interesting. And what was interesting about that experience initially was that how we came to realize that we were interested in a lot of the same concepts, but that our vocabularies didn't allow us to communicate very well. And so to some extent, we had to come up with a vocabulary that we could agree on, what the meaning was. So a lot of it was just learning how to talk to each other.
And do you have a sense for, it wasn't just, like you said, it wasn't just the economists who were there, and it wasn't even just the sociologists. There was people from other areas of the social sciences as well. So do you have a sense for what that shared purpose was? Like, what did everybody hope this concept of social capital might be able to achieve?
I think we were all interested. We all had a common desire to explain human behavior. And I think we all came to realize that how people connected to each other mattered. And we wanted to learn from each other. And no one clearly had all of the information or all of the insights. And I think what made that initial group work was that we were kind of boundary type people. We were people that were kind of willing to look over the fence of someone else's discipline or sub-discipline and try and find out, well, what are you doing over there that could help me understand what I'm doing? So you had to f find the right kind of people that were interested in sort of connecting, looking over each other's fences.
Yeah, and I think the shorthand that we've come to apply quite often for social capital is just the saying that relationships matter. It's just a very simple way of saying that there's more going on than just the exchange of goods. Talking about myself, I became interested in social capital quite a bit later than you did. It was probably the late 1990s and early 2000s even, and I was interested in why some community groups were more effective than others. And I was clearly seeing that the nature of the relationships forming in those groups and the ways in which these people in those groups were able to mobilize their connections or their other forms of capital to achieve the group's desired outcomes was quite different from group to group. And I happened to come across the already established by that stage concept of social capital that seemed to be talking about the same thing. And so I think I probably shared the same kind of interest that the interest group you're talking about in the 1980s had that it's relationships matter. It's more than just these other things that tend to get focused on that we need to take into account and prioritize.
It's interesting that you had mentioned that. So my background was that relationships didn't matter except collectively in the marketplace. And so one of the first things that I wanted to test was, do relationships matter? And one of the early studies that involved researchers from lots of different states in the sale of farmland. And so we asked, who did you sell it to? What price did you sell? What was the arm's length price? And the strong outcome, which resulted in several papers, was that the price that you sold your farmland for depended on who you were selling it to. And that a lot of the farmland sales never took place in a formal marketplace, but over someone's kitchen table. And so once we had that as sort of the encouragement to continue saying that under really what economists would call a market condition, relationships mattered a great deal. And so from there, we tried to build on sort of that insight that, yeah, relationships matter, who you sell, who you sold to, what the terms were, all kinds of things, at what level you would exchange. So there wasn't, I think it was a relatively small percent of people that would ever sell to somebody they didn't like. So it just changed the way I came to think about markets and market transactions and how buyers and sellers interact.
And I think it's interesting that this concept of social capital really didn't particularly exist until the 1980s, or perhaps even the 1990s, when it started to become more popular. We see in the literature the occasional mention of the term social capital. John Dewey in 1900, 125 years ago, just about. We see Jane Jacobs. We see these limited uses of the of the term, but very little in the way of concept until the 1980s. And the way we've just been discussing this, it seems like the concept of social capital really came as a response to, or as a result of, the way in which neoclassical economics was theorizing human behavior and human exchanges. And as you've just explained it, we can really understand by now that there's no such thing as an arm's length transaction. Like the basis of neoclassical economic theorizing is something that almost never exists, that we relationships matter in so many areas of our life as we have now come to appreciate it. So do you think that would be an accurate categorization, that social capital really came out of the way in which economics had been doing its theorizing?
So, I would not claim economics and sociology is such a broad field, and there are concepts in economics like warm glow and related concepts. So, I want to be careful in saying that all economists are, have this view of an arm's length transaction. But as I started learning about relationships, I was really struck by some writings in the 1700s by really the founder of modern economics, Adam Smith. Most or a lot of economics students will refer to Adam Smith and his work, The Wealth of Nations, an inquiry into the causes of wealth of nations, in which he described the butcher concerned about his selfish interest in his transaction. But prior to that was his book on moral sentiments. And the first chapter in that book was titled Sympathy, which we would translate now as empathy, which empathy didn't exist at the time, in which he makes this really interesting reference to people feel most intimately the well-being of their family and friends and others and their influence, describing kind of a metric of relationships, some which matter a lot, others which matter less, and that these relationships alter the terms and level of trade and exchange and willingness to sacrifice. So, in my case, I would say that I think Adam Smith may have had more to say about social capital than we give him credit for, as early as 1776, something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly the idea of social capital is not a new is not something new to humans. We've always been cooperative, we've always worked together, but the nature of trade has always been based on relationships, and that's plain for all of us to see. I guess the thing is that we didn't have a way to describe that, a term for it, until really, I guess, the 1980s. But now we do, and now we can use that then to focus on what it is that we actually mean, and to dig into the ways in which these social relationships influence our exchanges or our actions towards others, and how then we may be able to improve the outcomes, how we may be able to develop this capital, this social capital, to be able to achieve greater outcomes. And so I think that seems to be what we're talking about overall, and the real value of what the concept of social capital is.
So, if I could just continue on that thought, one of the really important concepts that Adam Smith introduced was that specialization increased productivity. And his famous example of the pins that one person pins because we didn't have zipper Velcro, I suppose. But anyway, that one person working alone could scarcely make one pin a day, But if you got 10 men working together and divided up the task, they could make thousands of pins a day. So that the increase in productivity went from 1 to 1,000 per person to 2,000. So that's an interesting insight. And nearly, I think most economists would agree that productivity is heavily dependent on specialization. But if you specialize, you can't trade, or you have to trade because you give up producing everything to specialize, and you have to trade for what you no longer produce. So at the heart of productivity is exchange. And I have come, and I think we agree, that trade depends to a significant degree on the relationship between trading partners. So in that sense, I find I can't separate out sort of the idea of specialization in trade and commodity production and so on from the importance of relationships. And Thomas Friedman has has an example of a political stability called the McDonald's model, and said no two countries go to war if they have a McDonald's, if they share a McDonald's, because they find some advantages. So I think at the heart of I think, at least in my discipline, I connect it much more in a very almost, I can't think about productivity and trade without relationships. It just seems like it's such an important part.
And it seems like productivity is one of those really big outcomes of what social capital is. And it's something that we should care about a great deal. In the media recently, there's been discussions about declining productivity in the modern workforce. And perhaps some of the reason for that is a lack of focus on social capital. And we hear about certain companies that limit bathroom breaks and try to extract productivity from their workforce in ways that perhaps aren't particularly helpful to fostering what we mean by social capital. And so this perhaps is the reason why we should be concerned about it, and a big opportunity for organizations of all kinds, not just companies that make products, but organizations of all kinds to perhaps to potentially improve their productivity.
So I think what you're describing is, I think what I saw when in some observations of factories and productive settings in Mexico, or, in the term of maquiladoras for workers, and I was struck by the difference between, in one factory, workers were discouraged from talking to each other or integrating. The turnover was very high. In another one, it was just the opposite. They ate together, the bosses circulated, and so on, with a very low turnover. And so I think I was, led to ask, what happens in a relationship? I mean, we say relationships matter, and I, at least in my work, found out, yes, they matter a great deal. But then you come back to the question, well, what is going on in relationships? Is something being exchanged besides commodities? And so I think approaching relationships from a lot of different disciplines is kind of the way we make progress.
Yeah, I think so. So we've got a lot to talk about in future episodes. Today we've really just talked about the where the term came from, why perhaps it's needed, a little bit about maybe what it does. But join us again for the next episodes, because we're going to get into this, and we'll talk more about but what it actually does, and how it actually works, and how the theory can actually contribute towards the kinds of outcomes that we're interested in. And particularly how an economist and a sociologist can actually communicate on these kinds of issues, because it's really fascinating how we so often use different language, but when we explain ourselves, we can come to understand what the other person means, and I think from our previous discussions, we almost always end up agreeing.
It's been exciting and a real pleasure for me to visit with you, Tristan, and find out how much we really understand alike once we get past some discussions and definitions that allow us to communicate a little better.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Lyndon. Look forward to the next episode.
Me too.